You reach for the top olive oils and invest in the best pans. But in the kitchen, how well do you care for your greatest tool, your hands? When mine take a beating cooking and cleaning, which is often, I use Bag Balm to work its wonders on my poor, distressed skin. Created 125 years ago on a Vermont dairy farm, their soaps smell great and clean hands without stripping moisture, and their fast-absorbing lotion means I can quickly get back to cooking. Treat your hardworking hands to Bag Balm, every chef's best friend. Use code FOOD52 for 20% off your order on bagbalm.com. Good through 2024.
At Total Wine & More, find the best gifts for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for sis or a single barrel bourbon that dad will love. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21. Where can you find the best gifts at great low prices that everyone will love? At Total Wine & More, of course, with so many great bottles to choose from. Find something for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for your sis, sparkling wine for a coworker, or a single barrel bourbon for dad. And if you need any help, just ask one of their friendly guides for advice. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21.
What's going on, everybody? I am Peter J. Kim. I'm the host of Counter Jam, which is a new podcast on Food 52 that celebrates culture through two of what I think are life's greatest things, food and music. And I'm super excited to be here doing a live taping of this show. It's the first time we've done this. And we have a dynamite guest, Michelle Zahner, the Korean-American artist and mastermind behind the music project Japanese Breakfast, and of course, the author of Crying in H Mart. Michelle, thank you so much for coming on. It is so great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Right on. And, you know, I was watching some of your newer music videos, which are dope, by the way. And I couldn't help but notice, obviously, like, I'm a food guy. So when food shows up anywhere, I always kind of, like, zero in on it. And I was watching the music video for Be Sweet and also for Posing in Bondage. And I noticed that a certain food makes an appearance in both of those music videos. Instant ramen. And I wanted to ask, first of all, was that intentional?
We introduced the ramen in the Roadhead video from the Sauce Sounds from Another Planet. So we kind of already had this template. And my cinematographer and I love an Easter egg. And I also found, you know, since I direct all my music videos, that as an actor, which I would never describe myself as, I feel really uncomfortable if I don't have something to do with my body. So I always am trying to, like, concoct different ways to feel comfortable when I'm being filmed. And I also think because you have such a short amount of time to get a sense of character across, that type of food is, like, such a quintessential kind of, like, slacker character food to have on screen. And so I think that that's sort of where that came from. But of course, I am a big Chin Cup fan and will stand until I die.
Well, I beg your pardon, but slacker food, hey, look, I like, I think about 50% of the molecules in my body have come from instant noodles in one form or the other. So I have to ask, okay, so I'm it's interesting you said Chin Cup. My question for you is, how do you rock your instant ramen, you know, favorite brand, and then how do you sort of dress it up?
I definitely am a Chin Cup eater, and but I think that Chin Ramyeon is, like, so genius that they had this product that everyone, like, will buy forever, but they're always advancing it in some ways. Like, I think that it's really amazing that they started making the noodles circular. You can just put them in the pot because they were square before. And they didn't have to do that. They were definitely, like, selling enough noodles. But it's just that they care. So they're still innovating, which is really respectable, in my opinion. But I'll cook Chin Ramyeon in, like, the, you know, like, that tin Korean pot that heats up really fast. And then, of course, crack an egg at, like, the last minute. And have to have like really tart jeonggak kimchi on the side. But I also in the last couple of years, I can't really eat it anymore because, to be honest, my stomach can't. I love spicy food, but my stomach really does not. And but I do really like the buldak bokkeumyeon, like the samyang noodles, the fire.
Oh, that's like the spicy. So, though.
Yeah, like the 2-time spicy noodles that like all the mukbang people eat with a slice of Kraft American cheese. It is so good, but it hurts me so badly that I really can't eat it unless I have nothing to do the next day.
First of all, I want to say I love that you call that the circular noodle cake, and it's true that. To me, that's like the little hug that Shin gives you every time you open up the package. It's like, look, we know you. You don't have a square pot. You've got a circular one. And we made a circular noodle cake just for you.
Yeah. They're like, you know, life is hard enough. And we want to make it as easy as possible for you.
I mean, we've all been there where you have that square noodle cake and the circle pot. And it sits on top of the pot. And you're just like, fuck. You know, you just want it to go in, but it won't because it's just like... Just those corners need to be shaved off. Are there any other ways that you like to like sort of tweak your instant ramen?
Those are like the two main ways. I feel like I don't get too creative because I'm usually eating this type of thing like really late at night when I shouldn't be, or when I'm like really hungover and I've woken up at like 6 o'clock in the morning, just really dehydrated and starving, and my body's just like, please. Put something inside of you to like soak up whatever you did to me the night before. So that's pretty much, those are my two staples.
May I suggest you try two different little twists here that are
easy.
Oh,
please, bring it on.
I mean, it will like up your instant ramen game. So first, tahini. Like
ew.
In the beginning stage when, what? Did you say ew?
What the hell?
Okay,
what kind of like,
pause.
What kind
Tell
of
me,
like,
what,
you know,
what is
bougie,
tahini?
It's like a sesame paste.
Yeah, it's
I guess that's
seeds.
Fair. Yeah.
So,
but I wouldn't put that in my ramen either. So,
well, I want you to try it before you knock it too hard.
Okay.
Because if you put it at the beginning,
it's like
and
hummus.
You give it a nice stir with your chopsticks.
Hummus ramen.
No. Think about, look, you've had those ramens where it's like it's got that like really like creamy sesame broth to it, right? This kind of takes it a step in that direction where you have, especially if you get the tahini like mixed into the broth, it gets to this like creamy sesame thing and it's really good. Just trust me.
Okay, what's the ratio here? It's like one package.
A good dollop.
A good dollop.
Yeah.
In the beginning or like at the end?
Definitely at the beginning. Has to be at the beginning because if you do it at the end, you'll end up with a glop of tahini that's not mixed in any way. You have to do it before the noodles are in.
Okay,
while
I will
the
say,
water's simmering hard.
This is like an upscale version of, like, I feel like there are bros in college that are like, oh, no, you gotta just put, like, a dollop of peanut butter in it. It, like, makes it. This is, like, an upscale version of that. You know, like, those, like, crusty punks that do that.
Your bar
are,
for
like,
upscale,
looking for
I have to
sustenance.
Say, in your
it.
Bar for upscale, with all due respect, is
it's low.
Tahini. Okay. All right, I can respect that. I can respect that.
I'm a musician. My expectations are very low in life.
Okay, let me give you a second idea that's even easier. Just take a knob of butter and drop it in at the very end.
Okay, that's legit.
Like,
I like that.
Straight up, like, it just makes this, like...
I do
I
that with
know,
my jjigae like, sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
butter. Just it's really good on your shin ramen, and it just... Oh, it's like coat your lips. It's so good. As I just feel like the one thing that shin ramen's kind of missing is some fat in the broth, and they just because they haven't like figured out a good way to powder fat, and so there you go. But before we go too far into talking about food, I actually wanted to play a song of yours, which is off your upcoming album. Oh, it's already out. Actually, I just listened to the whole thing, so it is already out. Jubilee. And like no joke, I was like listening to it all weekend and just like bopping around to it. Love it so much. And so we're going to play a clip from a song called Savage Good Boy. Before we play it though, and Coral's going to get that queued up. Just could you say a few words about what the sort of background on the song was?
Sure. Yeah. I think I was just reading a news headline about billionaires buying bunkers. And I just thought that the alliteration was both funny and menacing, and I was just interested in exploring the perspective of a billionaire who's kind of rationalizing greed at this really high level, kind of coaxing a young woman to come live with him in his bunker underground as the world sort of burns around them. And you know, in his mind he sounds very like it's a very rational thought. It's about survival, it's about playing the game. But I think that you kind of present these facts, they sort of become more menacing and evil the further along it goes.
Wow. Okay. That's so interesting to hear. And then, of course, if you watch the music video, the ending is pretty, it's pretty amazing. So anyway, I won't spoil it for folks. They should watch the video. But yeah, let's, Coral, let's play an excerpt from Savage Good Boy. That was Savage Good Boy by Japanese Breakfast, a.k.a. Michelle. Amazing, amazing song. And we're going to listen to another tune from the new album. But I wanted to make sure that we talked a bit about, of course, your book, which is called Crying in H Mart. And Michelle, I know that you have been talking about this book a lot lately, and so I'm going to kind of sidestep some of the more like down the middle questions about the book. I think folks, if they want to learn more about it, there's been a lot of really wonderful interviews talking about the book. And I mean, in brief, I guess maybe could you just give people, for those who aren't familiar with it at all, the sort of like quick synopsis of what the book's about?
Yeah, the book is called Crying in H Mart. For anyone who doesn't know, H Mart is a supermarket chain that specializes in Korean groceries, but you can also find a lot of other sort of ethnic groceries there. And after my Korean mother passed away, I found myself visiting H Mart a lot and crying there because it reminded me so much of her and my childhood, and it became a real refuge for me in a way to sort of preserve that part of my culture and her memory. And so the book is about learning how to cook Korean food in the wake of my mother's loss.
Yeah, and it's just truly beautiful.
Thank you.
And I have to say, the part that really resonated with me the most is this whole theme of thinking about, especially, you know, the immigrant experience and thinking about your parents, and for those who are lucky to have known their grandparents as these sort of cultural lifelines. I grew up in the Midwest, so, you know, somewhat similar situation to Eugene, Oregon, where you grew up, where I was in like No-Nameville, Illinois, and not a lot of Koreans around. And, you know, I mean, I grew up mostly wanting to just sort of fit in, and my Korean's horrible. I don't really speak Korean. I mean, it's funny, like, I do with my parents. Like, with my parents, I can have a whole conversation in our version of Korean. It's like, I speak, like, Kim family Korean, you know? like, of which there's, like, four speakers in the world, you know? And, like, you know, outside of the context of my family, I think, like, I have like mixed feelings about my Koreanness because, you know, I don't speak Korean. I haven't spent much time in Korea. I go to a Korean restaurant. My friends ask me, it's like, oh, is this the authentic, like real thing? I'm like, I don't know. You know, it's like, I just know what I had in the Midwest with like the weird, like improvised, you know, stuff that we would eat.
Right.
And so like, truly like my entire Koreanness is like staked on my relationship with my halmoni, my grandma, who passed away, rest in peace, a while ago. And my mom. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess I just wanted to get into that a little bit more and just think about, you know, how has your sort of perception of your Koreanist changed since your mom's passing?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it was I don't know if I questioned my Koreanness because I was so preoccupied with my Americanness for so long. And it just felt like this inherent part of me that I never had to think much of because I wasn't confronted by it very often. And then when my mom passed away and I started thinking, will my kid never know this part of me now that she's not there unless I preserve it? Or do I lose this whole part of myself because she's not here anymore? I realized that if I wanted to interact with that part of myself and this huge part of my history in general, just my personal history, that I was going to have to actively work to interact with it and preserve it and kind of go out of my way in this way to interact with it in a way that I had never had to think much about anymore. And that was really stressful. And I think it kind of manifested in learning how to cook these dishes and, trying to forge this relationship with my last remaining aunt and visit Korea and make sure that was going to continue to be a part of my life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have to say, and this is like a weird thing I actually don't really talk about too much, but I mean, I have this like very deep fear of my parents passing, and you know, they're older. My mom is 70, boy, turning 75 this year, and my dad's about 80, turning 84. And you know, I do think a lot about now, just trying to really, like, I almost feel like I'm just really so, like, thirsty to just capture their cultural identity somehow. You know, I it's like I want to just keep recording oral histories with them and just like record videos of my mom cooking. And you know, I think part of it's that, like, with my grandma, I remember thinking, like, one of my life goals was actually to learn Korean before she passed in order to be able to.
Mine too.
Yeah. Did you have, do you have Korean family members with whom you have a difficult time communicating because of the language barrier?
Yeah. I mean, my Aunt Nami, you know, it's tough because, like, both my mom's younger sister, Eunmi, and her both passed from GI cancers within just a couple years of each other. Mm. And I was actually really close to my chaginimo because she was fluent in English and she studied English in college. And so, you know, whenever we went to Korea, she was always, it was always my mom or her translating. And then once both of them had passed away, my kunimo, my mom's older sister, and I really struggle to connect. And it's so frustrating because I feel like this woman is like my last connection to my Korean family. And also I have so much to say to her, just like really complicated emotions and, you know, information and feelings and secrets that you can't really express in body language in Konglish. You know, it's like, it's already hard enough to have those types of conversations when you're fluent and both fluent in the same language, let alone both of you not having this major language barrier. So I remember when I was a kid, I would go to Korea every other summer and have this renewed interest in, you know, learning Korean, because every Friday, like most Korean kids, I went to Hangul-hakyu at the Korean church. And, you know, when you're a kid and you're in elementary school and then you have to go to school again on Friday when all of your friends are hanging out and having sleepovers, you're just like, what the hell is this? Like, this sucks. And so, like, my attention span was just, I was not having it, and I was miserable there, and I definitely acted out quite a bit and never really retained much. And every time I came back from Korea, I'd be like, oh, I'm going to, like, come back and be able to have a conversation with Hanmini, and, you know, I'm going to focus on Korean school. And then, you know, maybe the first lesson back, you know, you're, like, kind of at attention, and then, you know, you quickly slip back into bad habits because, you know, you just want to get back to your life. But, yeah, I had that again. I have that again now, and I kind of feel, and I don't know if it's bad that I'm revealing this so often, but I do have this interest in writing another book about learning the language and documenting that experience for a couple of reasons. One being, you know, I don't think I'll ever do it if I don't make a project out of it. And so someday I would like to live in Korea for at least a year and document the experience of learning the language.
Oh, yeah.
And the second is, like, I feel like, you know, that's another part of, you know, the search for my identity and feeling of belonging is that, you know, the only way that I'll feel more connected to it in a natural place where I left off, is, you know, the lack of language skills that I have. And also having written a memoir, so much of the difficulty of that is like searching your memory.
Yeah.
For material, that if I were to just go over there and start a project about learning language, everything would be, you know, present That's day right. material that would be pretty easy to harvest.
Plus, I have to say, I think Korean is a pretty amazing language, you know? Like I said, I mean, if you put me in like a random Korean restaurant in New York City and try to like have me talk my way through ordering, I'll just get a lot of like really like scornful looks. But with my family, I'm like totally good. And I think one of the things I can still rock pretty well is the Korean wine, you know, like, oh my, like Korean whining is like on a whole nother level where you do that warble, you know what I mean?
Totally.
Oh my, and I mean, the other thing I love about the Korean language is just the really like almost like animal like noises you make when
totally.
Talking, like the there we go, you did it, jinx. Yeah. Can we do like a jinx? Oh my god.
Yeah. Also, I feel like Korean people have this very aggressive way of like brushing their teeth, where there's a lot of like really aggressive like hawking of spit,
oh, yeah.
like and phlegm like into
oh, my
the
god.
Sink after they're done.
Yeah.
My mom did that.
I love it. I mean, I think it's just what a great way to really like emphasize something is to just rock that sound. You know?
Oh, just, I also love like when you take a shot, they're like,
yes.
like you're blowing out steam or something.
Oh, I know. And like, yeah, I mean, and like just the various expressions of surprise, like, oh my no.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, and then there's like the rapid fire aigo. So aigo means like, I don't know, like I'm tired, like ugh, you know. And like, but the thing about aigo is if you say that, the level of your tiredness is directly coordinated with the frequency at which you say it. So if you just say like aigo, you're like, okay, I'm a little tired. But if you're like aigo,
oh yeah, yeah, like, when you're oh. getting up, I've noticed that as I get older, I've like started to do that.
Oh yeah, the frequency is going up. Right.
Or also, I feel like there's like when Korean people are talking to each other, there's this like constant like moaning affirmation that's like oh yeah,
absolutely. And it's a way, I think it's a good way to like socially connect while somebody's talking. It's like, I'm listening, I'm here, I get it, you know.
Totally.
I love that. Did your mom ever talk to you about food that she ate growing up in South Korea?
Yeah, I mean, every time we went to the Korean grocery store, she would talk about how, you know, she had this food when she was growing up. And I mean, I think, you know, for everyone, imagining your parent at your age, especially like when you're younger, is like this totally bonkers idea. Like I talk a little bit about it in the book in the beginning where, you know, my mom would introduce me to different snacks that she ate as a kid. And I was just like, you were a kid? Like, like I can't, when did you eat snacks? I remember being like, you know, cause my mom didn't really, as you get older, I feel like you maybe snack less, or at least like my mom did. And, being just shocked that my mom used to eat like things out of bags. Because like she was so kind of like, she had this real like, she was really like, kind of like sophisticated, or like she had an elegance about her that imagining her like putting jangu like on her finger or like eating out of a bag was kind of like, you did what? Like you made the jollibong like spoon out of the plastic card ate this too. It was like really wild to me. So yeah, I think I really connected to her like younger self in a way, like through the things that she would call out in the grocery store. And that was like, I think, you know, in writing this book, I realized such a natural reason why I sort of fell into food as a kind of comfort vehicle was, it just made me feel connected to her, you know. It reminded me of those moments, and also that, you know, she really rewarded me in a way. She really delighted in seeing me exhibit similar interests as her. When, you know, it was her way. If I ate well and I ate Korean food, it was her way of thinking, that's my kid. Yeah, I know that that's a Korean kid.
Oh,
like a,
man.
Like an American kid wouldn't naturally like chotgal or like, you know, these like funkier Korean things, but like my kid is all about it. Or like, you know, just little weird things. Like, I didn't know if this line was going to fly, but I was talking to EJ Ko, who's another Korean-American writer, and, and she was saying, there's a scene where I dip like a Korean pepper into doenjang, like just naturally without anyone telling me to do that. And my mom being like, that's like the old school way to eat it. Oh, that's my kid. You get it. And no one even has to tell you. It's a natural thing for you. And I was like, I don't know if people are going to like get that. And that was something that she called out that I was really comforted by. Because, I think that was like a natural reason why. I was just like, I realized I was constantly being sort of rewarded by this type of behavior. And maybe subconsciously was what led me to kind of seek comfort in it.
Are there any dishes in particular that you and your mom particularly enjoyed making and eating together?
What did we, you know, there are certain Korean foods that are like, or I guess in every, in most cultures, there are like certain foods that are real events, you know, like it really takes multiple people to do it. You know, I feel like kimbap is something that like, I remember my mom showing like me and my friends how to make like when we were younger, because like if you're gonna do it, it's best to make a lot of it because you're already like preparing all of these like vegetables in this very particular way, so it's better if everyone's involved. And also making dumplings, like I remember, you know, learning how to fold dumpling skins like really terribly and, like you know, just like the making a day out of stuff like that was really fun. But I also, you know, I one thing I really love is like, you know, being in tune with, this sounds really like woo-woo, but like being in tune with like the seasons or like the earth and just like what it's telling you you want. Like the other day, it was like 92 degrees in New York, and I feel like every Korean was eating naengmyeon yesterday.
Of course. I was. I had naengmyeon.
I was like, I really want mul naengmyeon right now. And like, I saw my friend Noah was like eating pibing naengmyeon the other day, and I was like, oh my God, I feel like every Korean is eating this dish right now. And I feel, I love that kind of connective, that feeling of connection that like the like the season is bringing something in and that we're all like enjoying this thing together. And my mom was sort of all about like everything, it felt like a theme or like an event, and I really love that aspect of eating. You know, every time it was nice enough to eat outside, she'd bring the butane burner outside and we would you know, grill samgyeopsal, and you know, we'd you know, have the sam, or like we'd have kalbi, and it was just like such a fun thing that we could like do together and look forward to and associate with the season. Or I remember every time that it was a rainy day, we would make sujebi, like these kind of hand torn noodles in like a seaweed broth. I guess it's like kind of like a dashi or whatever. And yeah, I remember, like, my mom would, like, make... My mom's dough, though, is, like, not like any other Korean's dough. It was, like, definitely, like, a lot wetter. And I remember, like, making, like, these, like, grossly shaped little... It's kind of like a Korean gnocchi, almost. I remember, like, you know, when you're... It's, like, a fun, messy thing to do as a kid to, like, pinch the dough off together into the soup and eat it on a rainy day. So I always remember stuff like that.
What you're saying... Everything you're saying is just, like... really underscores for me why I, and I'm obviously heavily biased here, I just think Korean food is the best. and I'll tell you why, though. I mean, I think, you know, people always talk about Italian cuisine as being this, like, ingredient-forward cuisine, which it is. But to me, like, Korean cuisine has it on another level because all of our, like, side dishes are single-ingredient dishes, right? It's like... And the name of the dish is like the name of the vegetable. Like if you're eating spinach, it's like shikimchi. You know, that's just what it is. And then if it's zucchini, it's just hobak. It's just, that's the word for it. And like all of the dishes on the, it's like, it's so easy, I find, to take Korean cuisine and to work with what's in the market and to like turn the season into like dishes on the table. And on top of that, what I also find really compelling about Korean food is, you know how like, when you get in the groove of making Korean food, it's like you have your Tupperware containers, you bring them out, all the like side dishes, and they go back in the refrigerator. You kind of like add a new side dish, but you bring out the old ones, and you maybe like add a soup, but then like, you know, finish the old soup. And then like, it's just kind of like this constant evolution of like leftovers plus like new stuff.
That is really lovely.
And I like that because there's this kind of like dance between, you know, the food that you ate yesterday and even a few days ago and maybe even like, you know, longer than that. And like what's coming in, and it can like kind of roll with like changing things that are available or seasons. And so, plus, of course, like, you know, you're talking about like the old kimchi, like the kimchi itself, everything is like moving with time, like the pickles, everything is like changing. You know, your kimchi today is like going to be really different 2 months from now. So there's a certain organic sort of like evolution and dance to the cuisine that I find really beautiful, that I appreciate. But also, you know,
I love that like everyone can create a totally different bite from what's on the table. And that's why I feel like Korean moms are always like yelling at you to eat in a certain way, because they're like, no, like this is the best way. They're always like bothering you to eat it in a specific method, or like everyone feels like everyone has a different way they make their like some barbecue. Or like, you know, a bite is going to taste totally different if you eat the meat with like one banchan or two banchan or a different sauce with the garlic. You know, there's always like different formations for it, and I feel like I don't know if you have this problem, but like every time I go to a restaurant, it's really hard for me to just order one dish, because I'm like, well, I want to like have all these like interactive bites. Or if I eat pizza, I always have to have like a pickled pepper on the side. Or if I eat a sandwich, I always like, there's always like some kind of like tart, spicy substitute like on the side that I feel I need to have.
Oh, yeah.
Are you, like, one thing that I don't like, though, that I don't get is like if you go to a Korean, like an Italian restaurant in Korea, they'll serve a side of pickle, like sweet pickles, if you order pizza or spaghetti, which I find totally bizarre.
Well, I mean, my first memory of eating sort of Italian-esque food in Korea was like when I was 12, so a long time ago. And I remember having pizza there, and it was
pizza.
It was like, I don't know how it is today, but back then it was like ketchup on this like really flavorless dough on with like peas and corn on it, and
They American love putting kind of corn on pizza.
And I was like, ugh. I mean, it's just not stay in your lane. It's basically like what I say to those folks. But I did want to just give a note to when you talk about Sam, and to me, I mean, to at least from my experience as a Korean American, Sam is at the heart of like the way my family eats. I mean, like we always have a bowl full of like lettuce on the table. But I always find it funny when I have non-Korean friends over and they make Sam. And what do you think like the biggest, most common error folks make is when they make Sam with lettuce?
The thing is, it's overloading it.
Oh my God. I see so many people try to like just like put like so much in there, and then just like you watch the trepidation as it goes towards their mouth, and then they take a bite and the whole thing disintegrates.
Maybe I've never seen it because I'm like very involved in helping.
Oh, there you go.
Wait, what is your sam like combo?
Like my sam combo is, I like, you know what? So I like to keep it pretty simple. So for me, dream sam combo is like, you know, fatty meat, whether that's galbi or, you know, whatever. And then samjang and just a little dollop of rice and like just a little kimchi in there for the acidity. And that's like, to me, that's perfect. That's
I like, red leaf, like a little bit of rice, galbi dredged in like samjang. And then I like thinly sliced garlic on the inside. But if it's pork belly, I have to run it through the sesame oil, salt, and pepper. But it's like pretty much the same combo after that. And I've recently trained myself to like genim, like the sesame leaf. I used to really, or the perilla leaf. I used to really not like that taste, and it made me feel like I wasn't.
Yeah, it's a very particular
Korean
taste.
And so I trained myself to get into it, and now I do like it.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I have some either or questions for you, Michelle. So I want you to tell, I'm going to give you two options. You can tell me which one you prefer. All right. So first one is tteokbokki, which is, you know, this like spicy rice cake dish, or tteokguk, which is a rice cake soup.
Oh, that's really hard. But I think tteokguk.
Okay. Okay.
I know tteokbokki is hot right now, but I feel like I have, you know, when it's like cold out, or like what would we eat for New Year's?
There you go. Yes. All right, I have one that's a little cheeky. Japanese breakfast or Korean breakfast?
Oh, Korean breakfast.
But here's a follow-up question to that. What is Korean breakfast? Because I still haven't figured that out.
I think it's just like, for me, it's just like rice and guk, you know, like rice and soup, like a jjigae or something.
Yeah. I wanted to make sure that we had some time to listen to another track from Jubilee, which I love, and it's a song called Be Sweet, and I actually just love same thing, would love to hear just some background on what the thinking was behind the song.
Sure. I wrote this song, this is probably the first song that I wrote for this record on, without thinking about it. I was in LA and my publishing or my label connected me with Jack Tatum of the band Wild Nothing. And your label will do this tricky thing sometimes where they basically set you up on a blind date to try to, you know, get more publishing money out of you. And so they'll say, oh, Michelle, like Jack from Wild Nothing loves Japanese breakfast. He needs help writing his new record. Like, and he thinks you can help him. And I was like, great, I'll help him write his record. And similarly, they were like, Jack, Michelle from Japanese Breakfast loves Wild Nothing. She's writing a new record. She needs help. Like, will you help her? And so we both got to the studio and we're like, so I'm here to help you with your record. And we were both like, I'm not writing a record. What are you talking about? I thought I was helping you. So the two of us were just like, I guess we should just write a pop song and like maybe we can sell it to some, you know, like teenager or something and make some royalty points off of it. And I came in with this synth lead line and had this lyric in mind that was just like, I think because I was writing for someone else, I was like going for a more like sassy diva that I wouldn't normally channel. And there's this Raymond Carver story called Tell the Women We're Going. And so I inverted that for the first line and I wrote, you know, tell the men I'm coming. And I was just like, who would say that? What kind of like sassy woman would say that? And I just channeled her into the night, you know, and that's how that song kind of came together. It's basically like a sassy woman telling a man off.
Yeah. I love it. And, you know, it's funny what the song made me think of instantly when I listened to it. Have you watched the show Black Mirror on Netflix?
I've watched a couple episodes.
Have you seen the episode called?
To be honest.
Oh yeah, it's a little scary. But there's one episode that
Well, no, I like some of it, but like, sorry, go ahead.
Well, there's one episode that is a little more, not so bleak, and it's called it's episode San Junipero. Did you happen to see that one?
Oh yeah. I've seen that.
I mean,
one,
I feel like, you know, I'm not gonna spoil it for folks who have not seen
like
this episode, but
no, that is the color palette for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, like that episode is what it's about is. And this won't really spoil anything for anybody, but it's about timeless love, really. And to me, like listening to Be Sweet, it's like it sounds a little cheesy, but like it makes me think of timeless love. And
Peter.
And I love it. So I guess with that, Coral, I don't know if you could tee up an excerpt from Be Sweet.
Feel the night passing by like a mistake.
Sorry, there's like fireworks going off in my neighborhood right now. wonderful. But that was Be Sweet.
It's just timeless love happening around
you. Timeless
here.
Love happening everywhere. Yes, yes. Oh, God. What an amazing track. It's so perfect. The whole album is so perfect. I definitely recommend everybody go and check out Jubilee as soon as possible.
Thank you so much.
So I wanted to close out by asking a question that I ask every one of my guests who comes on Counter Jam, and it goes as follows. So let's imagine you are stuck on a deserted island and you can only eat one Korean dish for the rest of your life on that island. What would it be?
Kimchi jjigae.
So quick. Love it.
It definitely is like kimchi stew is like my comfort food forever. Yeah. Forever and always when I go on a long tour and I come home or if I'm hungover or like, you know, I just need something to stabilize me. Basically my Korean breakfast is like a really funky kimchi jjigae with white rice and like a really runny egg, like egg on rice. Mm. Those two things, like all of those three things, like working together is like by far my favorite. My favorite.
Oh,
food.
Yeah.
I don't think I could ever get tired of that dish.
Me neither. Me neither. I mean, I tell people that I can go from zero to kimchi in a shockingly short amount of time in the morning. It's like, wake up.
That's our body. Stretch, our biology.
Kimchi, ready to go. Yeah, yeah. Totally. You know, a lot of folks, they need to like kind of ease in their palate into the day. And for me, it's like, no. Like, I go straight into it.
But I think that's like Asian culture in general. We just like, it's like dinner now.
Yes,
I'm ready for my morning dinner.
Okay, so I have to ask you then, how do you make your kimchi jjigae?
Okay. I've gotten like pretty, I have like my thing, I guess. I like to start with like a pat of butter and then some thinly chopped onions, really funky kimchi. It's kind of nice because H Mart sells like aged kimchi, like 3-month-old kimchi, and it has to be aged kimchi in order for it to taste good. Then I'll toss that around with some fatty pork belly. Water, tofu, gochugaru. And the secret is like a little dollop of doenjang. Like Korean.
Oh, yeah, I like that.
I don't want to like isolate everyone, but like, yeah, it's like Korean. It's basically like Korean miso. It's like fermented soybean paste. That's like that's the umami.
I would say doenjang to me has like a lot of really interesting flavors though that miso. I like miso too, but I'm definitely a doenjang.
It's funkier. And yeah, saltier. Sure. But yeah, I feel like most people are surprised to find that I don't put gochujang in my kimchi jjigae, but I don't think it's necessary.
Yeah, no, I don't put it in mine either. The thing I do like to do...
Yeah, tell me your secrets.
Oh, my secrets. I would say I don't
what
have
I like
secrets.
To do is put a dollop of tahini. Really just need to add those fats. Just...
Oh yeah, there you go. There you go. Mozzarella cheese is dropping in there. the two things I'd say I do that maybe not everybody does. One is I use bacon.
And, oh, whoa, weird.
So yeah, bacon is a really yes, it's very, very good in kimchi. Oh, look, hey,
that's
hold up.
That's
all
crazy.
Right.
It's too smoky.
And then this it's so good. It's good. Just give it a whirl.
Okay.
And then second I like to dope my jjigae at the end with kimchi juice.
Oh yeah, you gotta do the kimchi juice.
Yeah, yeah. Essential. But I like it to be uncooked. So I like to know that some of it's still alive when I'm eating it. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
it's a little weird, but like yeah.
That's smart.
Yeah. So I do like really at the very end and it's still got that really like raw
sharp
garlic
tinge
to it.
Oh, that's a good idea. That's smart.
Yeah. So those are really all, I mean, otherwise I feel like kimchi jjigae kind of like, it's got a really warm embrace that pretty much takes anything in. And honestly, like kimchi jjigae is like the dish that probably connects my mom and me the most too. Mm. I mean, like she, she loves watching me make kimchi jjigae, and I love watching her make it. And then we love just like trying each other's. It's definitely like the thing that we make for each other whenever we see each other. So
does she like yours? Is yours different?
She loves it. She's open-minded about bacon, interestingly enough. And she's 75 years old.
Wow.
No, she does like it. She does like it.
She's like, Peter, tahini no soya.
There you go. There you go. Michelle, I want to thank you so much for coming on for this live taping of Counter Jam. I want to thank everybody for joining us, and I want to thank Food 52, Coral Lee, and the whole team for helping us put this on. And for everybody out there, listen to Jubilee by Japanese Breakfast, read the book Crying in H Mart, and get ready for, I guess, the movie, right? That was like exciting news you got today. Yeah. So, but yeah, thank you so much, Michelle. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Thanks, Peter. Thank you guys so much for having me.